Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Hello, everyone. I'm Harvey Brownstone, and today's guest is a four-time Emmy Award-winning TV talk show host, producer, journalist, author, and public speaker. He's hosted numerous TV shows, including the New York-based Midday Live with Bill Boggs and Weekend Today with Bill Boggs. He was the host and executive producer of the syndicated Fox TV series Comedy Tonight, and he was the founding executive producer of Court TV and executive producer of the groundbreaking Morton Downey Jr. Show. In the food media world, our guest is a legend. He created and hosted the PBS TV show Home Cooked Classics. He helped launch the Food Network and pioneered the first ever national restaurant review show, TV Diners. And he created the long-running hit show, Bill Boggs' Corner Table. He also had an enormously popular one-man off-Broadway show called Talk Show Confidential, which ran for 6 years. He's interviewed many of the most notable personalities of our time, including celebrities, world leaders, business tycoons, writers, athletes, celebrity chefs, and many more. He's also a highly accomplished author. His first book, entitled At First Sight, is a novel that's been optioned for a Hollywood movie. In 2007, he published a highly acclaimed book entitled Got What It Takes? Successful People Reveal How They Made It to the Top, which contains candid interviews with 44 leaders in the world of entertainment, business, and sports, including Sir Richard Branson, Clive Davis, Norman Lear, Diane von Furstenberg, Renee Zellweger, and yes, even Donald Trump. 3 years ago, he published a hilariously satirical novel entitled The Adventures of Spike the Wonder Dog, about an adorable English bull terrier with a politically incorrect sense of humor and a heart of gold, who rises to fame on his master's TV talk show and on social media. And now he's released the laugh out loud, but razor sharp satirical sequel entitled Spike Unleashed, The Wonder Dog Returns, in which the fiercely loyal Spike and his faithful master Bud continue their hilarious antics. These books demonstrate that our guest is indeed a master of social commentary. You've seen him on the Today Show, Good Morning America, Fox and Friends, PBS, My Generation, and dozens of other TV shows. And now I'm delighted to welcome the one and only Bill Boggs to our show. Bill, thank you so much for being here.
Harvey, thank you. That's the best introduction I've ever had. It's also the longest introduction I've ever had. Hence, that's why it's the best. More about me. Thank you. Thank you very much for that. I appreciate it's well-written. Because I wrote it myself. Well written. Thank you. Thank you very much, Harvey.
Well, you're very welcome. You know, Bill, before we discuss your latest book, I must tell you that as an interviewer, I consider it a great privilege to interview someone whom I've admired for years because of your unique and probing interview style. What made you want to be an interviewer?
Radio. I'm just old enough, Harvey, to remember and be part of, as a very, very little boy, I mean, 3, 4 years old, 5 years old, of the end of the golden age of radio, when radio had dramas, live comedy shows, and shows where people were interviewed, like Arthur Godfrey's show and the great Art Linkletter with People Are Funny and Don McNeil with The Breakfast Club. And my parents, my whole life changed because my parents once had just a couple extra dollars and saw a little radio in the window one day, a little white Bendix radio with a dial. And they gave it to me when I was about 4 or 5. And that radio actually formed and changed my life in a couple of ways. The first is, and it's really a forgotten term, Harvey, radio was called the theater of the mind. I don't know if you've ever heard that, you're aware of that, but it really was. one would just, like me as a little kid, I lie in bed 7 o'clock at night, listening to radio, seeing the Lone Ranger, thinking I could see Jack Benny, Mr. Keene, Tracer of Law. And that, for many years, at least the next 7, 8 years of my life, really focused my ability to have an inner, as Stevie Wonder said, an inner vision. That's what radio did for my imagination. The second thing it did was I was entranced as a little kid, particularly by Art Linkletter, whom I was honored to get to interview later on. These are pretty much becoming forgotten names who I wanted to be like the men on the radio. And I used to walk around with a pen. My mother told me this. I do not remember it. I used to walk around, Harvey, with a pencil in my hand, pretending I was interviewing people, or walk out to the neighbor and ask them a question. So I am one of those incredibly blessed people who was able to make that childhood dream come true. I grew up and I became a television, not a radio, but a television interviewer.
How would you define a good interviewer?
Well, I think to be a good interviewer, you have to be reasonably prepared. I always thought Larry King would say he doesn't really prepare much. And sometimes I would hear interviews where he should have been better prepared. I think, A, to have some basic preparation, which I'm sure you have for today's show. But in the process of interviewing it, and the largest percentage of my work, even with one shows I did on the Food Network called Talking Food, when I would substitute for Robin Leach for long periods of time. That's the first year of the Food Network. Live. Most of my interviews have been live. And listening would be the number one thing I would say. And then having an aura about you and your personality that helps the guest whom you're interviewing to feel relaxed. Because the more relaxed a person is, the more likely they are to be expansive. I'm very relaxed now. That's why I'm going on like this. So they would be my, some preparation, not total preparation. Be willing to listen and not be looking, oh, what's my next question? And listen with the intention of understanding, not reacting and going to your next question. By the way, what's your next question?
Well, my next comment is that I really appreciate what you just said, because I have to tell you, although Zoom is an amazing technology, which allows people like me to do what we've done and to build the audience we have, it's also, there's a flip side to the coin, and that is that everybody thinks they're an interviewer, and you see a lot of amateurs out there these podcasts. Yes. So I'm very gratified, Bill, to hear you talk about preparation, about listening, about asking good questions. And I hope you'll feel by the end of this interview that I'm in that league, because
I can already tell. Plus, I did a little research on you. I'm honored to be among the wonderful guests you've had. You know, in the author category, you've had terrific people. In the music category, in the so-called celebrity category. So I'm honored to be your guest.
Well, it's a great honor to have you here. If you're a coffee lover like me, it's always fun to discover a great new blend. I recently found a terrific new company, Breakfast at Dominique's, that's created a series of coffee blends to honor the legacies of the greatest Hollywood legends. And I'm thrilled to tell you that now, Breakfast at Dominique's has introduced the Harvey Brownstone Talk Show Blend. It's my very own exclusive, delicious, bold, rich, balanced medium roast coffee, and I just know you're going to love it. It's made from high quality organic beans produced using fair trade practices. If you'd like a great cup of coffee, give Breakfast at Dominique's a try and order the Harvey Brownstone Talk Show Blend at HollywoodBlends.com. They'll ship it right to your door anywhere in the world. Sipping our coffee is the perfect way to watch our show. Now, you've interviewed a lot of big names, but probably no one more controversial than Donald Trump. And that was long before he became president. What did you make of him?
Well, I've known Donald Trump. It's difficult to talk about Trump because we see him as the president. He was never a friend of mine, but they're being in New York since 75 and being out there in social and having a girlfriend who was out there at the time. run into and meet a lot of people. I mean, I could give you names of people. I've had never had conversation with them sitting down. It's always at an event, you're standing up or something. And so I first met Donald when he, in 1975, the first year I came to New York, at Regine's nightclub. That's the night I also met Geraldo Rivera the same night. They weren't close friends then or anything. So all of my, you know, Donald really respects success, and I was successful. So he saw that, and I think that would make him more interested in me than if my TV show had bombed, the ratings weren't going well, if I hadn't moved on to boxing and the Food Network and all that stuff. You know, that said, the last time I he was interviewed once on my television show, only once, and then for the book, Got What It Takes, Successful People Reveal How They Made It to the Top, he's the only guest, when I say among the 44 people whom I interviewed, who wanted his questions in writing, and then he would answer them in writing. So whether he answered them or not, I don't know. But the man who became president, I had no insight into any of the behavioral characteristics. I knew he was somewhat self-centered, but as Sinatra once said to me, I take people as I find them, okay? The Donald Trump I found was a guy who was fun to talk to, reasonably interested in you, quite involved with himself, but not an objectionable person, you know, a pretty good and interesting vibe. But that it gave me no insight to what he'd be like as a politician.
Now, you also interviewed his ex-wife, Ivana Trump, didn't you?
Yeah, Ivana Trump. After they broke up, Ivana was on my, she was on the Food Network show, Bill Box Corner Table, and interviewed her at her, this show was a scam. So the Food Network was, I was on other shows there, but they were looking for something that wasn't just a pure cooking show. This is early. I was on the Food Network the night it went on the air in 1994 when it was launched. And people thought I was nuts to leave WNBC to be on the Food Network. But I saw the same thing the investors in the Food Network saw. And that was a concept of food meshing with entertainment. Anyway, so I had this idea for a show where I would get this, sit down with celebrities in their favorite restaurants, right? Eat, which turned out eat for free, be on television and get paid for it. They actually paid me for having lunch with Sophia Loren. That's my favorite one. I cashed that check. So Ivana was on that show. And then she invited me to go with her to Radio City Music Hall with a couple other people, not like a date. She had a date, one of those counts, the guy she ended up marrying, a couple of them. And we went to see Julio Iglesias and afterwards met Julio. It was fun. Had a big night, in what I call a big Friday night in New York City.
Wow. When you're interviewing a big movie star, do you ever get starstruck?
No, not really. Even my early days of being associate producer of a show in Philadelphia, and I was on once a week as Mr. Weekend, telling people in Philadelphia what to do on the weekend. We had major stars, but this was the days when actually a movie star, like say Robert Mitchum, a major movie star, would be on a tour promoting his movie and would be live on Philadelphia television at 9 a.m. in the morning. So I felt comfortable with the celebrities I met. I knew their work. No, I wouldn't say I ever got, I could be excited that I was interviewing, you know, James Bond, but not particularly starstruck.
Well, I have to confess that I do get starstruck. Now, one of the things I admire about you, Bill, as an interviewer, is that you're incredibly brave. I'll give you an example. When you interviewed Elliot Gould, you actually had the guts to play part of a Barbra Streisand song, The Way We Were, and you asked him how the song made him feel. That was a very brave thing to do, don't you think?
Well, you see, here's the thing. I've gotten a lot of, I just posted that. I have this YouTube channel. It's called Bill Moggs TV. And I urge somebody, if you're interested in seeing I've got almost 500 videos on there. A lot of people were talking about. James Bond is on there. Sean Connery, Ivana Trump is on there. Lots. So I just found the Elliot Gould thing. We posted it. The thing was, Elliot Gould was promoting a movie, Harvey. And he had been on other shows and was really notorious for being a purposely bad guest. Not a shy guest, not somebody who stuttered, not someone just purposely sort of sitting there smirking a bit and sending up the host. So I just thought, all right, if I think that's what he's doing on the show with me, I'm going to set him up, say, now you're an actor. Actors are suggestible people. I want to put yourself in the situation. You're driving along. You're on a long drive by yourself. It's a rainy afternoon. Windshield wipers are going. You turn on the radio and you hear this song. Memories like the corner of my mind, sung by his former wife, Barbara Streisand. And he was drinking water at the time, and he spit it out like that. It worked. He loved it, he said, after the show. And it was just my comeuppance for his purposely not being a good guest. That's the last time I saw the guy. So it wasn't particularly brave to do that, I didn't think.
I beg to differ. Now, of all the interviews you've done with famous people, Bill, do you have a favorite?
Well, Sinatra would be my favorite interview, yeah, because he had never been on a talk show, Harvey. This goes all the way back to the dawn of my New York show, Midday Live with Bill Boggs, which is on New York, and actually was in other locations. It was on the Armed Forces Network. It went on down the East Coast up in New England, a big, big reach, but it was a regional show, a local show, not network or syndicated. Anyway, so Frank, I've been a lifelong Sinatra fan. My mother was a Bobby Soxer. My father loved big band music and Frank. And I snuck in to see Sinatra at the 500 Club in Atlantic City, New Jersey. And I really fell in love with Frank that night. I snuck in dressed as a busboy with another guy. And I started buying every album. That was the early 60s. So after I saw Frank at the 500 Club, I started having a couple of times a year, a recurring dream, a very pleasant dream. This was before I was a talk show host, that I was sitting in a room and talking to Sinatra. We're just talking to each other. And I always woke up feeling so happy. Now, sometimes, you know, dreams are weird. Didn't look like Frank, but it was always Frank. So I was set to go for Easter weekend, April 1975, to Las Vegas. Friends of mine were having a birthday party for a mutual friend. And we got Elvis reservations for the first show and Frank Sinatra reservations for his second show. So we saw Elvis and Frank the same night, a big, big Saturday night in Vegas, right? So everybody, except for me, was really bombed. I mean, they had been partying all day. I had been part of it, but I was quite cogent. I love Sinatra's. I've seen him many. I saw Frank like 82 times live over the course of 40 years. Anyway, the morning of the trip to Vegas, I woke up and I had that dream. You know, sometimes you have a dream in the morning. It's like a waking dream, Harvey. Yeah. The dream was really vivid that I was sitting in a chair talking to Frank. And I thought, this is a precognitive dream, maybe. And I said, the executive producer of Midday, I'm going to Vegas this weekend. Yeah, I know, Bill. You know, don't come back with a hangover. No, but I have this intuitive feeling that somehow I'm going to meet Frank Sinatra and he's going to come and do Midday. And it happened. Boom. So if that can't, and he had never been on a talk show, had never done an interview like that, turned out to be the longest interview of his life. And it all happened because I was introduced to him by Jilly Rizzo at 3:45 Easter Sunday morning, and Frank and I connected, and Frank, without my asking, volunteered maybe he'd swing by and do my show in September. This is April, and he did. It was meant to happen, and from that day forward, I had a really good connection with Frank. It was wonderful to me and my mother.
Wow, that's just phenomenal. I want to give you some names of people that you've interviewed and ask you what comes to mind when you hear their names.
Oh, I like that. Yeah, that I only did that one other time many years ago. All right, can I close my eyes when you do this?
Okay, if it helps.
I'm not going to fall asleep. All right.
All right, let me start with Bill Cosby.
Bill Cosby, fellow Philadelphian like me, played on Temple football team. Of course, he was in the Navy and he was older, was one of my high school football players on our football team. Always friendly and nice to me, helped me enormously when I was on the Food Network, volunteered to do a pilot for me, and couldn't have been more supportive of me in my career.
How about Martha Stewart?
Always liked Martha Stewart. I've had a lifelong crush on her. Not a major one, but Martha Stewart, when I met her, her first book was Pies and Tarts. I thought, this is one beautiful woman. She's so talented. But I can be a little shy, and I never pursued it. But I like Martha Stewart very much. She's a mogul. She's a mogul of the highest degree. She's like Barry Diller with a wig.
How about the Smothers Brothers?
Oh, my word. That and Martha Stewart interview is on Bill Boggs TV. Part of the Sinatra interview is on Bill Boggs TV. A long interview with Cosby. Cosby is on Bill Boggs TV. And so are the Smothers Brothers. That was my Food Network show, Bill Boggs Corner Table. Spent the whole afternoon with the Smothers Brothers. Two different locations. Went to see their show the night before. Just great. I mean, they're, you know, a little older than I am, contemporaries. And if you're a Smothers Brothers fan, and people, you know, are forgetting about them, I said, how long you got, their act is like a polished jewel. How long are you guys going to continue performing? As long as the people will come out, we'll be performing. And I see that they did a show last year at the McCallum Center in Palm Desert. So I'd love to see them again. They're terrific fellows.
Yeah, I was a big fan. Now, you're one of the only people who interviewed both of Lucille Ball's children, Lucy Arnaz and Desi Arnaz Jr. What were they like?
Oh, Desi and I've been friends with, and I interviewed Lucille Ball too, and Desi Arnaz separately. Lucy Arnaz and I, to this day, are very close friends. I haven't seen Desi for a while. He and I spent some time going out in New York, partying a little bit when he was engaged to Linda Pearl, the singer, and Lucy Arnaz and I dated for a while. And so they're just terrific people, really natural and real pros. These children of show business stars grow up in the business and they just know it. No one has to teach them how to be a guest or anything like that.
What about Lucille Ball? What was that like?
Well, Lucille Ball, I met when I was on a press junket for my show in North Carolina. And when we get to the book, what bring me back to that, I had to show Southern Exposure in North Carolina. And I was on a press junket when she was in MAME, the movie MAME. So I interviewed her. Unfortunately, it was a 16 millimeter film. And the film has the film, because of a flood in the basement of my apartment building, not my house, the film and many other of my interviews, like interviewing Sonny and Cher with little Chastity on their lap, got destroyed. I had some really good, there's a few that survived, but very, very few.
What about Hugh Hefner? What was he like?
Well, Hugh Hefner and Christy Hefner, his daughter, is brilliant. She should be a senator. She's really a smart woman. Hugh Hefner was on Midday once, and then I did when I was on Channel 5, that's WNAW with Midday Live, I had an offer to do a 90-minute special, not live, for NBC that replaced the Saturday Night Live one Saturday night. So the special was called Friends, a stupid title. I was hired, I did not produce this. And it involved, the premise was being with celebrities on vacation. So we had Telly Savalas in London at the Knightsbridge Sporting Club. We had Lindsay Wagner, the million dollar woman, right?
The bionic woman.
Cap d'Antibes Hotel. God, that was great. And Hugh Hefner at the Playboy Mansion, because he never went on vacation. Hefner was great. I mean, you end up thinking about the last of these people, like, you know, some people only see Elvis as the fat Elvis. They don't see this really hep, unbelievably cat. And with Hefner, the last couple of years, you know, the TV show, he became looking like a parody of himself. But the guy published a brilliant magazine for many years. I mean, yeah, it had nudity in it, but it also had some of the top writers of our time, jazz polls, all kinds of things, and was, to a certain extent, helped the sexual revolution to move forward. There's a lot of negatives. You see, I'm talking to you from a positive aspect about these people. If I were interviewed for a documentary about Hefner, I might introduce other things, but I'm just giving you the positivity of the experience. He was terrific to me.
Tell me about Howard Stern. Was it fun to introduce
Was great. The guy's brilliant. I'm not an envious guy. I envy his success. I love Howard Stern.
Now, because we're filming this show here in Toronto and I have a large Canadian audience, of course, Bill, I can't resist asking you about your interview with the mother of our Prime Minister, Margaret Trudeau. What did you think of her?
Margaret Trudeau was on the scene of Studio 54, and I didn't really get to know her well. I can't comment really too much about Margaret Trudeau. She's very attractive in her prime. I really can't give you a definitive thing. She was on my show once. The interview was on Bill Boggs TV, the YouTube channel. And boy, people have said a lot of negative, people can leave comments.
If you could interview someone who's no longer living, who would you choose?
Oh God, that's a good one. I think the first name that came to mind was Franklin Roosevelt.
Really?
Yeah, to talk about his political skills, working with Churchill, what he did to bring the country out of the Depression and through almost the end of World War II, the development of the bomb. I think I would say, why didn't you tell Harry Truman about the atomic bomb, Mr. President? Yeah, that's the first one that came to mind. Marilyn Monroe. Forget about that. I want to interview Marilyn Monroe. Send the president packing, folks. Get her in here. Get her in. All right.
I can't blame you for wanting to interview Marilyn Monroe. I would too. Now, I don't know if you're aware of this, but I'm a retired criminal and family court judge. I was a judge for 26 years. So I have to ask you, what inspired you to create Court TV?
Court TV was the idea of Steve Brill, who published the Law Review or some kind of a monthly publication for lawyers. It was his idea. And what happened was I was the founding executive producer of Court TV, but Brill was steering the ship. So Steve Brill deserves all the credit for Court TV, not me. I worked for Steve Brill, who was the creator.
Now, as I mentioned in my introduction, you're a legend in the world of food media. Tell me about your love affair with food.
Who doesn't love food? I was, for 6 years, I had a wonderful relationship with a woman who was an artist and a chef. And I had the idea that she'd be wonderful on media, on television, as a chef. This is before the Food Network. So we started doing a radio show in Greenwich, Connecticut called Let's Eat. It was a two-hour show on Saturday. We interviewed celebrities. Like, a great question for celebrity. We asked the same. What was the dinner table like when you were 10 years old in your house growing up? Always an interesting answer. Anyway, and then when I saw the Food Network was coming in, I had done on midday a weekly roundtable where we'd have eight guests, like maybe all weathermen or writers or whatever, and we'd actually have lunch because the show was on midday, was on at lunchtime. We'd actually have lunch. And people love these roundtables. So I took that, and when I was at WNBC, I did this thing called Bill Boggs Corner Table, where once a week it was a film piece, it would be like a feature piece. And people really liked that. And so I, in a way, the only thing I've ever invented in my entire career was the concept of interviewing people and eating at the same time on television. And then when I saw the Food Network coming in, I just jumped at the opportunity to be in on the ground floor, and they gave me a lot of leeway. I did TV Donners, and I substituted for Robin Leach. I did a couple specials for them, and then Bill Boggs Corner Table. And on that, yeah, and I was on, they had a a really interesting half-hour show about food news. There's nothing like that. The Food Network has gone completely what I call plastic. A lot of, throwing chefs, and it started out as really authentic, and it just got more. They ended up firing me and all the original people after we were on for about 8-10 years. They thought we were too old. We got replaced by younger people. They really wanted the young demographic. So when I saw that the Food Network was being created, the man at Reese Schoenfeld, whom I knew, I immediately went to him and I said, look, I've been doing this radio show for 2 years in Greenwich. I told him some of the things we were doing. People don't think of me as being associated with food, but I really know restaurants. I'm not a chef, but I take me into any restaurant and I can give you a critique of what I think. Because restaurants are not just the food. It's first off, the way you're greeted. You never get a second chance to make a first impression. The general atmosphere, sound level. You'd be amazed, and it's just because of my age, how many people say, I'll never go back to that restaurant. It was too loud. The service, the food, and the customer base, the kind of people with whom you're dining. So Reese hired me, and he said, we're going to find a lot of things for you to do. And I had a good 10-year run on the Food Network. And then I invented that show, Bill Box Corner Table.
So, yeah, you had an amazing connection to that network. Now, your off-Broadway show, Talk Show Confidential, was a unique theatrical production full of great anecdotes, video clips. You share many insights about the world of talk shows. I understand that show may form the basis of a movie about your life. Is that right?
Well, the show and my first novel, which you mentioned, At First Sight, was optioned by Renee Zellweger several years ago. But she loved it. She was my neighbor. She loved my show. And then I said, if you like that, you should. She said, you should make this show into a movie. I said, Renee, it's not what I do. I mean, I'm not a screenwriter. She said, oh, I loved it. I said, I wrote this book that is also based on a guy. And I gave her the book. And 3 days later, she said, oh, I love that book. At First Sight, she said, I want to option the book and I'm going to option your show, which essentially would have been optioning material from my life. And she did. But nothing came of it. And that's not to put Renee down. I've said this to many people. If I could have a daughter, I would like her to be like Renee Zellweger. Oh, absolutely wonderful woman.
Yeah, she's adorable. Okay, Bill, let's talk about your latest book, Spike Unleashed.
I happen to have it here. Just hanging around here.
There it is.
The Wonder Dog returns as told to Bill Boggs, because the dog... narrate, the dog tells me the story and I write it down, and the dog essentially it's not in the first person, it's in the first dog. The dog is narrating the story. The book is satire and it's designed to make you laugh. The whole point of this thing is to make you laugh.
You wrote your first novel 40 years ago. What made you decide to start writing novels again?
That's a good question. Thanks. Well, what happened was two things. The last TV show, I've identified whether I was on television or executive producer, Morton Downey Jr. show or Court TV or whatever I was doing, I've always identified as a television host and personality. And the last show I was on, which turned out to be, in fact, the last show I was on, My Generation, for AARP on PBS, that went off the air after about 5 or 6 years, management changes, reset. And I was standing here in the living room in New York in my apartment, and I thought, I'm in my 70s now. If someone wants me for a television job, this is prior to the pandemic, I'm easy to find. I have an agent, I'm easy to find. But I'm going to now go back to my roots as a comedy writer, and I'm going to identify as a writer of satire for the rest of my life. I actually stood over there about 10 feet away and made that decision. I just changed the compass in my mind from, okay, Bill, you're a TV host. You have to get another job on television too. I'm a writer. And that's what I'll be doing for the rest of my life. I've been writing since childhood. Frequently, people say, well, how come Bill Boggs is writing? I thought he was a TV host. What is he... People, if you have a talent, it can go in many directions. And I have a limited talent, but the talent I have is big. And I'm not bragging. If you said, Bill, I think you should have been a judge, a lawyer, a dentist, a doctor, an airline pilot, an engineer, I would have bombed. I mean, it wouldn't have happened. I used my gift essentially as a public speaker as to parlay that on the television and producing.
So tell me, why did you decide to make a dog the main character and narrator of the book?
It's very difficult to explain that. The dog, it just happened. It happened that way. I wanted to write a book based on a talk show host like me, so it starts out close to home, set in the world of television and media, that mirrored something in my life. My first big show was called Southern Exposure with Bill Boggs. On that show, hold it, I had a dog like this, an English Bull Terrier. This is Little Spike.
Hey there, Harvey. How you doing, baby? You're short, pal. You're short.
That's Little Spike. And Spike the Wonder Dog was killed. He was very popular. He got more mail than I did. He was killed by a drunk driver shortly before I came to New York. The idea that I had, and I have no idea where I got it, was this. What if Spike hadn't gotten killed and came to New York as a talk show host like me in today's world and becomes a big TV star and social media star? Okay, that's all I had. And I thought, okay. And I sat down to write it, and the voice of the dog came through me. I don't mean the actual dog, Spike. The character came through me, and I was suddenly writing with nuances and a texture and a melody of the writing I had never written in before. So I can like summon Spike at will. It's just part of the mystical creative process of writing a novel.
Well, besides being hilariously funny, book has been described by critics as a shrewd social commentary that pokes fun at everything from the Kardashians and reality TV to power politics, sexual dysfunction, political correctness, show business, and fame. What drives your sense of humor, Bill?
Just looking at our society. I mean, looking at the things that exist in our society and sending it up. A lot of my humor, it's absurdist humor. Spike in the first book, The Adventures of Spike the Wonder Dog, he starts out as a young dog. He's just barely housebroken. He's like, say, a teenager would be. And then the book goes on for about a year and a half. And then Spike Unleashed picks up after the pandemic. So Spike is now essentially more mature, more seasoned. Sees more in society than he did in the first book. That's a rambling answer. It just happens. I just write it, and it just like reality TV, right?
Does satire come easy to you?
Yes, it comes easy to me through this character I've created, Spike the Wonder Dog. If you said, "Don't write satire in the voice of Spike," write it. I might have the ideas, but I have a difficult time putting them down as shrewdly. It doesn't mean all the material is wide-ranging, but there's something about putting myself in this world and sending up stuff. For example, I'll give you an example. There are many inventions in the book. One of the, in a certain extent, I'm old school, right? One of the things that I look at that kind of annoys me is excessive gloating in sports. For example, the end of every tennis match. And that's the picture you see in the New York Times. All the end zone dances, all this stuff. So one of the many inventions in the book is something I came up with called Gloat, G-L-O-A-T, Gloat Camera. And Gloat Camera is just focused on gloating in sports. And once a week, there's a 30-minute show that shows you the highlights of this week's gloating. And now, it just annoys me. I can't explain it. And this, what's it, Carlos Alcaraz, he does it after every winning point, like that. Every kid on every tennis court in the world is going like that.
Yeah, so, I know what you mean. It's clear from reading your book, Bill, that behind the comedy, You're making strong statements about the current state of pop culture, show business, social media. What disappoints you the most about the entertainment industry today?
Oh, great question. I think that the overhyping of everything. Again, this is just my taste, but it's like taking a show and having to have fireworks and the camera going like this and lights flashing and stuff like that. And every guest who comes out, instead of walking out, is doing this game. It's just each successive year, our culture seems to get more and more and more like over the top. Even tattooing could just be a statement like, no, my normal body doesn't look good enough, so I'm going to get 38 tattoos. And what somebody does with their body, piercings, is not my business. I'm not critical of that. But the simplicity is gone from everything. And if you look at, for example, all of the singing contest shows, there's not a singer on, and I know music, there's not a singer on there who ever saw a soft note they want to hit. Everything is about the big notes, the big ending. As Sinatra would say to them, leave some place to go, meaning they're starting out like that and just going up and up and up. So that's a little bit of it. Again, these are just my opinions. If you like looking at somebody going after every winning point, enjoy it. But, you know.
Well, when you were at the height of your success as an interviewer, being a celebrity.
By the way, that was the pre-Kardashian era when that happened.
Right.
Yes.
I think you're making my point that being a celebrity really meant something. When someone was called a star, it was because they had real talent. They had accomplished something meaningful as an entertainer. Right. But today, social media can make someone a star even though they've accomplished nothing at all. If you were still doing interviews on TV, Bill, you would probably have to interview those people.
Well, yeah, that would be okay. I'd like that. That's really no problem. The attention span has changed enormously, and that goes all the way back to MTV. I interviewed the actor Tony Curtis four times. The first time was in my show, Sudden Exposure in High Point, and that's where both books start out. That's where Spike and his master Bud live. The next time was twice on Midday. The first interview was a full hour. The second one was like a half hour. Then the last time I interviewed Tony Curtis was 4 minutes. 4 minutes? He said, what's happened? I said, Tony, it's 1994. Everything's changed. Yeah, I guess so.
People don't have an attention span anymore.
Well, including that's one of the reasons I like writing so much, because I sit down and I am in for an hour and a half, 2 hours. There are no interruptions. I'm not checking phones. And I'm in the same thing with everybody else. I see people here in Manhattan, you probably in Toronto, on electric bicycles riding along and looking at their phones. That happens. Guys at the New York Athletic Club and women, I'll see them get out of the pool, and while they're still dripping wet, going over to their bag and they're checking their phone. And this is understandable. There's a payoff for it, you know, an endorphin payoff. It's just, you know, one of the things that I like to say is change is inevitable. Okay. People say, oh, it's not like it used to be. I always say nothing's like it used to be. Oh, it's not. Well, it isn't, right? Now, change is inevitable in your life. Growth from that change is optional. So I've grown just looking at what's happening in our society and writing about it in Spike Unleashed, The Wonder Dog Returns, my book.
Would you like to see your books about Spike made into a movie?
Yes.
So yes. Would I. I read that a portion of your royalties from the sale of the book are being donated to animal rescue organizations. Tell me about that.
Well, no, it's that simple. The first book involves Spike being kidnapped. And in the second book, he's got this nemesis, Ike, I Got Money Piles. So I thought, wouldn't it be nice if the book makes money too? And it's hard to make money in a book these days, Harvey. Thanks to you, we're getting a little publicity here. But I just thought it would be nice to donate money to an animal rescue organization. No, it's no big deal, but it's unusual to have. It's right on the cover of the book. It says that.
Yeah, I wanted our audience to know that. You know, Bill, when you look back at your career and everything you've accomplished in the world of entertainment, especially on TV, are you happy with the career you've had?
Yes, I am. But as John McEnroe once said to me, when I was interviewing him for the Food Network show, he said, you know, the older I get, the better I was. I think that people, you're very kind to say to me about all I've accomplished. Yes, I'm happy with my career. The little boy who was walking around the house with a pencil in his hand made that dream come true. I've
big time.
20 cruises around the world as a celebrity speaker. I've met all manner of interesting people. I've entertained people. Every day before I did any of my live shows, I had a simple prayer. If one person today can be helped by what I'm doing, I've done my job. And I've had people come up to me and say, you know, watching your show, someone said this and it helped me, and I decided not to quit school. So there was a little bit of that.
Well, one of the things you've done that really helped people was your book, Got What It Takes: Successful People Reveal How They Made It to the Top. You interviewed dozens of people who were leaders in their field, and you got them to share their secrets for how they became successful. So now let me ask you, Bill, what was your secret for becoming a success?
Resolve. I believe personal resolve. Saying to yourself you're going to do something, and then no matter what it takes, except for stepping on people, you know, go after that goal. So a combination of that and the belief in myself that I had a gift that I could employ, and if I couldn't employ it, I was in big trouble because I didn't know what else I could do. Necessity, in a way, being the mother of invention, and my success in high school was enormous. I was a treasurer, vice president, president of a 4,000 member class school, Abraham Lincoln High School, Northeast Philadelphia Public School, great school, and I had to be on stage every 3 days, reading information to the kids, and I had to win elections. And the day that I handed over the gavel, it's a very personal moment, to the new president as a senior, meaning I was graduating, the students gave me a standing ovation. And during that moment, I thought, if I can just use my personality as I have as a high school student, I can be successful in life if I can find a way to connect my personality. And after that assembly, one of the teachers said they'd never seen anything like that. So that moment, standing on the stage in high school, gave me the impetus for what I would do.
You know, that's very telling. It's very insightful, because when you say personality, I believe what you're really saying is likability. You became professionally likable. You made yourself likable publicly, which made you a very appealing television personality. You knew how to do that.
Well, I've never, ever, ever, just except for a couple of close friends, talked about this, but that day on the stage, I thought, if I can just find a way to amplify my personality, which had worked so well for me, not as a phony, but just a lot of stuff in high school. And
you did it.
I did. I was able to do that. I haven't thought about that for a long time. It's a very good question you asked me. Thank you.
I want to tell our viewers that you can learn more about Bill Boggs by going to his official website, billboggs.com, and you can subscribe to his wonderful YouTube channel, Bill Boggs TV.
It's free.
Well, Bill, it's been a real pleasure meeting you and having this opportunity to chat with you about your amazing life and career. Thank you for being such a great role model. Thank you for writing your books. Thank you so much for taking the time to appear on our show.
Well, Thank you. I'm honored to be here. And not to be coy, but in terms of likability, Harvey, you've got it. You've got exactly what it takes. So keep doing what you're doing. If you ever need me at the last minute, assuming I have Wi-Fi, I'm here for you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Bill. You're welcome back on our show anytime.
Well, that's a very nice thing. What are you doing tomorrow?
I'll let you know. Our guest has been the amazing TV personality, producer, and author Bill Boggs. His new book entitled Spike Unleashed, The Wonder Dog Returns is now available on Amazon and wherever books are sold. And remember, a portion of the book sales will be donated to animal rescue organizations. My name is Harvey Brownstone. Thank you to my producer, Steve Silver, my director of programming, Deborah Batsafin, my production assistant, Rosa Puzo, my PR director, Laurie Towers, and my entire team at the XBTV One Network in the UK. Thank you all for joining us. See you next time.
Thanks for watching. Be sure to check out all the great interviews on the Harvey Brownstone Interviews YouTube channel. Don't forget to subscribe and ring the bell to be notified when new videos are posted.